own right, as waves, and how they behaved when observed by human observers. He was speaking mathematically. The wave function is one of the chief features of quantum mechanics. But as we've pointed out several times, this elegant construct has never actually been seen in nature. It has to be inferred. The Heisenberg cut is useful not so much to divide the real world, but to divide the kind of mathematics that works on one side of the line or the other. It's like a border where only French is spoken on one side and only English on the other. But this begs the question of whether quantum reality really is isolated and separate from everyday reality. Perhaps quanta are making things happen all around us that we don't notice. Or maybe the whole picture has been turned upside down. Quantum behavior could be the norm in the everyday world, and we only happen to discover it first in the microscopic world of waves and particles. Not every theory of the universe requires the Heisenberg cut. The multiverse doesn't, for example. But without a doubt, the quantum lies at the horizon of our senses. We cannot visualize quanta, and now that dark matter and energy must be confronted, we may have reached the limits of what we can think about. What lies beyond the horizon is both everything and nothing. It is everything because the virtual quantum domain contains the potential for every event that has occurred or ever will. It is nothing because matter, energy, time, space, and we ourselves originate somewhere that's inconceivable. It becomes quite mysterious to reconcile the duality of everything/nothing in order to describe how creation operates. Light behaves strangely. To get a better idea of the implications for daily life, we'll examine the single experiment that lies at the heart of quantum mechanics, the double slit experiment, which has a history going back as far as 1801. Early experimenters were interested to see if light waves behave the same as waves of water, for example. If you drop a pebble into a still pond, its impact will send out rings of waves in circles. If you drop two pebbles into the water a foot apart, each will form a set of rings, and where the two meet, an interference pattern is formed that's separate from the overlapping rings. In quantum physics, this basic fact about wave interference embodies an enigma. In the classic double-slit experiment, a focused stream of photons, light particles, is broadcast onto a screen that has two slits cut into it. The photons that pass through the slits are then detected on another screen placed behind the first. A photographic plate would serve as a simple light-detecting screen. Each photon supposedly can pass through only one slit. And when it gets detected, what appears is a point, the way a pea shot through a pea shooter would leave a pinpoint where it hits. But if you shoot many photons through the double slits, where they land on the detection plate forms a bar pattern, typical of the interference pattern made by waves. In the everyday world, this wouldn't seem possible. It's as if a crowd of people walked through two separate doors to get into an auditorium, and after they sat down, it was discovered that every other seat was filled by a Democrat and a Republican, even though the people entered without giving any political affiliation. Photons passing through a slit individually have no prior affiliation with other photons, yet they gather on the other side in the pattern of a wave, not randomly like the scattershot of pellets hitting the screen. It is as if each individual quantum, going one at a time, interferes with the other quanta, even if they come in later. The double-slit experiment is the classic validation of the particle-wave duality of quanta. So the big question is why two opposite behaviors coexist. In physics, we say they are complementary, which is more accurate than opposite, because the same photon can display either behavior. Keep this complementarity in mind, because it holds enormous possibilities. In a universe where A no longer causes B, it turns out that A and B can be two sides of the same coin. To give an example from the natural world, in Africa, lions and gazelles share the same watering holes. In the scheme of things, lions eat gazelles, and gazelles run away from lions. But when it comes to water, they coexist. The lions can't keep the gazelles from drinking entirely, or else their prey would die of dehydration. The gazelles can't run away automatically, because then they would get no water. Over millions of years, the two species have found a way to make complementary compromises with their opposite roles as eater and eaten. Over time, the double-slit experiment became more complicated and intriguing. Quantum physics, as we've seen, depends for its lifeblood on measurement and observation. More than in any previous science, how an observer affects the measurement he's making enters into the equation, to the extent that von Neumann believed that quantum reality itself must have a psychological component. Is the observer changing the outcome of the double-slit experiment? The two sides of complementarity, wave and particle, can't be observed at the same time. In terms of experimental technique, it has also been enormously difficult to observe photons in the first place, because they are absorbed by the detector the instant they make contact. But the double-slit experiment is known to work with other particles, like electrons, and has even been roughly duplicated using molecules as heavy as those containing 81 atoms. How do photons make decisions? It makes physicalists very uncomfortable when the talk turns to photons making decisions and choices, or changing their properties depending on how they are being observed. Starting in the late 1970s, John Archibald Wheeler developed a series of thought experiments to test the crucial question. Do photons change their behavior because of the questions/intentions of the experimenter? The alternative is that they change their behavior for some purely physical reason, such as interacting with a detector device. Wheeler's thought experiment considered how a photon actually behaves in flight. Remember, a photon can't be seen in flight and is known only at the moment of detection. If a detector is placed right at the slit, it shows in real time that each photon passes through one slit, the way a pellet would. What if we place the detector after the slit? Wheeler asked. It turns out that the photon can delay its decision to behave like a wave or a particle until after it passes through the slit, which is very peculiar. But it was just as peculiar to suppose, as some theorists did, that in wave mode, a photon would be passing through both slits at the same time. Going a step further, could photons make decisions and later change their mind? This is a distinct possibility in Wheeler's thought experiment. For example, you can place two aligned polarizers at the double slits to cancel out any wave-like interference. Yet, if you then let the photons pass through a third polarizer that erases this effect, the photons will be restored to their original state and can behave like waves, producing the interference pattern that supposedly was erased. This twin phenomenon of delayed choice and quantum eraser makes it hard to believe in a strict physicalist explanation. The way a quantum is observed takes center stage. There were other wrinkles too. Physicist Richard Feynman proposed that if a detector for individual photons were placed between the two slits, the wave-like interference pattern would disappear. Both Wheeler's and Feynman's thought experiments have been generally accepted, despite great difficulties in setting up actual lab experiments to validate them. But do they solve the mystery of what the observer is doing to make photons behave the way they do? Like a ghostly apparition, The observer effect appears before our eyes, but we can't wrap our arms around it. Wheeler hit upon the right conclusion, we feel. He declared that physicists were making a mistake to believe that particles had the dual properties of wave and particle to begin with. Actually, quantum phenomena are neither waves nor particles, but are intrinsically undefined until the moment they are measured. In a sense, the British philosopher Bishop Berkeley was right when he asserted 2 centuries ago, "To be is to be perceived." In other words, there is no observer effect or problem, as if the observer is an intruder who pops in on nature, disturbing her privacy by peeking this way and that. Instead, things exist because they are perceived. This insight on Wheeler's part is why he insisted over and over that we live in a participatory universe. The observer is woven into the very fabric of reality. Suddenly, the human universe doesn't seem either far-fetched or far away. The quantum revolution is over a century old. Why hasn't the mind-like behavior of the universe become commonly known? Why is it not being taught in schools? If anything, the cosmos is more elusive now than it was in the first 25 to 30 years of the quantum era. In large part, the bafflement being felt today comes back to the Heisenberg cut. A strict division between quantum and classical worlds may work mathematically, but in reality, the dividing line is porous, blurry, and perhaps a mirage. If it takes an observer, seated squarely in the classical world, to prompt a photon to make a choice, seated squarely in the quantum world, how alien could the two realms be? So let's shift the emphasis and ask why we don't perceive quantum effects in daily life. Quanta are very small, but so are viruses, and they exert enormous effects all the time by causing disease. A cold or flu virus comes and goes in your body, but quanta affect you at every moment. Raise your hand and take a look at it. In this simple gesture, you performed a quantum activity, since sight begins with photons, which are quanta, striking the retina of your eye. Look at your garden and the trees outside. Photons of sunlight make them grow. So being microscopic isn't a problem with photons. Instead, we have some built-in mechanisms that act as blocks to truly perceiving what photons do. Can the brain be trusted? Nothing is real to us until we perceive it. And as it happens, the human brain is a very selective mechanism for perception. It can be as delicate as the most sophisticated photon detector. In essence, that's what the visual cortex is. While at the same time, the brain has no knowledge of how its own processes work. You don't possess inner vision that shows you the firing of neurons in your brain. A loud noise makes you jump because an automatic brain mechanism causes your response. But you can't witness it or the stress hormones, like adrenaline, that fuel the fight or flight response. The brain's blindness to its own activity is the main reason so many phases of life, like puberty or the effects of aging, surprise us when they arrive. A major drawback of naive realism is the assumption that the human brain delivers a picture of reality, when in fact, it doesn't. It delivers a convincing three-dimensional image of the world that is nothing more than a perception. Think about the double-slit experiment we just discussed. Most of its difficulty comes from the fact that photons are invisible when in flight, and are only detected as they perish. If light is invisible to begin with, there can be no way to make it visible except through a nervous system. And once that is accomplished, light is no longer its natural self, but a neural creation. Change the nervous system and light will change with it. An owl's acute night vision, the ability of an eagle to spot a mouse from hundreds of feet in the air, the underwater sight of dolphins, and a bat's ability to see using echolocation. All of these examples are radically different from human sight. Therefore, the assumption that we see real light is unfounded. There is nothing about photons that necessarily makes them visible. Billions of stars and galaxies are totally invisible until a nervous system turns them luminous. Perception is fallible because no two people see the world exactly alike. That's a given. But in many ways, the brain's relationship to reality is murky. Alfred Korzybski, a pioneering mathematician, set out to calculate precisely what the brain does when it processes raw data. First of all, the brain doesn't absorb everything, but erects a complex set of filters. Some of these filters are physiological. That is, the biochemical apparatus of the brain can't cope with all the signals being conveyed to it. Billions of bits of data bombard our sense organs every day, of which only a small fraction makes it past the brain's filtering mechanism. When people say, "You're not hearing me," or "You only see what you want to see," they are expressing a truth that Korzybski tried to quantify mathematically. But other filters are psychological. We don't see and hear certain things because we don't want to. Perception can be distorted by stress and high emotion, or any number of mixed signals in the brain. For example, if you are alone in your house at night and hear a loud creaking sound, you will react with alarmed alertness, because your lower brain, which is responsible for basic survival, has a privileged pathway when it detects possible threats. It takes a moment or two before the higher brain, the cerebral cortex, gets your attention. It decides whether the creak was a possible intruder or just a noise in the rafters or the floorboards. Once you make a rational determination, your brain mechanism can allow a balanced response, based on a clear assessment of the situation. Fire up the lower brain survival mechanism too much, which is what happens to soldiers at the front line under constant artillery bombardment, and the brain is prevented from returning to a state of balance. The inevitable result, no matter how brave and stalwart a soldier may be, is battle fatigue or shell shock. When the brain's coping ability has been overstressed, its perceptions turn completely unreliable. Then again, sometimes the limitation isn't about filtering. The things a person can't perceive may simply lie